Hello, everyone, and welcome to the American Immigration Lawyers Association podcast entitled Avoiding Surprises During DHS Interrogation. I'm Sarah Schwartz, A-List CLE Associate, and it's my pleasure to introduce today's panel. The discussion leader for this podcast is Matthew Hirsch of Wayne, Pennsylvania. Joining Matthew are Susan Fortuno Brown of Chicago, Illinois, and Patricia Corrales, former senior attorney of ICE from Pasadena, California. At this time, I'd like to turn the podcast over to Matthew.
Good evening or afternoon. This is Matthew Hirsch from Wayne, Pennsylvania. I want to say how happy I am to be joining with Susan Fortuno Brown and Patricia Corrales, both of whom have excellent resumes and experience in dealing with the Immigration Service. Susan, with her many chairmanships and leadership positions with the Immigration Lawyers Association, and Patricia, coming from many, many years working with the government on the enforcement side, and within the last several years coming over to represent immigrants in various kinds of enforcement proceedings. So good morning, and let's begin.
Morning, ma'am.
We're in a period of time where concerns about heightened enforcement pervade the immigration practice. The listservs are full of anecdotes of respondents being picked up at civil proceedings, at immigration court proceedings, heightened enforcement at the workplace, and other scenarios which are keeping everybody very, very, very nervously on the edge of their seats as to when ICE interrogations can occur. So let me throw it out there to Susan about first, when, how, or where ICE interrogations can occur, and what's your experience in that? Recent experience, let's say.
Yeah. Hi, Matt. My most recent experience happened about 4 weeks ago here in Chicago, and this is a very common scenario that we're seeing throughout the country, unfortunately. We attended an interview on form on an I-130 for a client who had been ordered removed in absentia from El Salvador, and she was ordered in Texas when she came in. Didn't attend a hearing, so she had an outstanding order of removal. When we attended the I-130 interview, the ICE supervisor showed up, and at the close of the interview, actually, told me that he was going to have to take my client into detention. Up until this current administration, we didn't have a problem in Chicago anyway. We weren't really seeing enforcement of outstanding orders under the Obama administration, and this is a significant change, I think, that has happened in my practice. You've got someone with an outstanding order. They attend an interview for an I-130 benefit. The marriage was entered into while removal proceedings were either pending or had already been completed with an outstanding order, and somebody's looking at enforcement. So this is what happened. I ended up having a very good experience for my client. We went upstairs to the ERO, Enforcement and Removal Office. My client was processed for an order of supervision and released 2 hours later. And that was about the best case scenario that you could see. So,
okay.
But that was definitely going to be quagmire.
Well, I've been reading about ICE officers showing up in unexpected places. And Patty, could you say something about the trends that you're experiencing, executive orders, enhanced enforcement, and what you are seeing that may be different this year than maybe last year or the year before that?
Of course. I think since President Trump signed the executive orders in January and again with the directives in February that were published by his Attorney General and the then Secretary of Homeland Security. Susan's correct. We are seeing an increase in enforcement all across the nation. In particular, what we're seeing, and I'm not certain if it's true in other states and other cities, but what is happening is that ICE officers are literally showing up at courthouse's steps, waiting for immigrants who have pending criminal matters to leave and exit the courthouse, and then they outright arrest them right in front of the courthouse. That has been happening quite often, and it's the new trend that is happening here in California. And I want to point out something to many members of the community. ICE officers have contacts within the local, state, and court houses so that they have information about individuals who may have no immigration status having a pending court hearing, a criminal court hearing, I should say, and they, you know, suddenly show up, and then they wait till the person's court hearing is completed, and then they arrest them. I think what's critical here is this. If you have a client who has an outstanding bench warrant or who has an outstanding criminal case that's ongoing, and you can appear for that individual without that individual appearing in criminal court, particularly here in California, we have something called 977, California Penal Code 977, that allows attorneys to appear on behalf of their clients if it's a misdemeanor offense. Certainly this can't be done if it's a felony offense. But if it's a misdemeanor offense, a misdemeanor bench warrant that's outstanding, by all means, appear on behalf of your client. Do not let your client show up at the courthouse because it's, you know, I would bet 9 out of 10 times you're going to have ICE officers present near that courthouse waiting for your client to come down the steps of those courthouses and subsequently arrest them.
Thanks, Patty. I wanted to go into some of those strategies in just a moment. But first, let's talk about when to anticipate the ICE interrogation. For example, Susan mentioned the scenario where somebody shows up for an I-130 interview where there's an outstanding order. That sounds like it's pretty getting to be fairly routine. Susan, what are some other examples of some indicators or triggers that might lead to an ICE interrogation?
Certainly workforce. Certainly the workforce has been stepped up. Raids are happening all over. Another thing that we have seen in Chicago and around the area in the Midwest is a very common tactic of ICE. They will appear at someone's home and say, we're looking for another person, but oh, by the way, what are your documents? I think, Patty, when we had our practice discussion earlier, you were mentioning this is kind of common. They really were going for that person, but they usually will sort of go there under the guise of we're looking for, you know, John Smith. He's not here. Well, let me just ask you about, you know, your status. And so that's a ruse. It's not the basis that they really should be making that application or that knock on the door, but both in the home, if there's an outstanding order, you know, ICE is really pursuing these a lot more heavily than they were previously.
Patty.
I agree with Susan in that type of tactic that ICE ERO officers use is very common. It's something that they're trained on. I, as a former senior attorney, would, you know, train some of our officers on the constitutionality guidelines of how to approach your home, when can you enter the premises, whether you need probable cause or not. Certainly ruses are part of a law enforcement tactic that's, you know, been used by police officers, by enforcement agencies for many, many years. I think another strategy that I think is very important, I don't know whether other states have certain regulations that the DMV provides for unlawful individuals who have unlawful status to obtain driver's license. We have something here in California called AB60, which is the driver license for those who are not documented in the state of California. You can apply for this license, show identification that this is you, show proof that you live in the area you're applying for that license in, and generally there's no issue. Now, at first, when AB60 was passed and came into fruition back in 2015, there was a lot of kinks that had to be worked out. DMV was giving the information to ICE, and suddenly ICE officers showed up at people's homes after individuals applied for licenses. That kind of ceased, really, after there was better training with DMV officials. And that sort of stopped, and then more people were applying for AB60. Now that we have this new administration, what we are seeing is that this whole applying for the license and then ICE showing up coincidentally is happening more frequently again.
Well, we've seen an example of that when somebody was applying for a marriage license and the person at the Marriage License Bureau was skeptical about the person's status in the United States, and ICE was willing to show up for that too. But let me move on to the question of how are we going to protect the client in the context of the ICE interrogation? What can the lawyer do to interpose themselves and protect the individual's rights in that scenario? Patty, you want to start with that one?
Matt, if I can,
sure.
And Susan, please feel free to chime in. I think what's important, absolutely, fundamentally important, is that an attorney properly advise a client that if an ICE officer makes contact with that individual and wants to take any statements or ask that individual questions, it is important for that to advise that individual, that client, to say, no, I want to speak to my lawyer. I have a right to speak to my lawyer. I do not want to answer any questions that you have for me. I need to speak to my lawyer, and insist on speaking to a lawyer. Additionally, advise your clients to not sign any documents. Not too long ago, a client showed up at my office. I happened to be on vacation. I had left instructions to my client that should this happen to you, because I knew there was an issue in his background, please notify the ICE agent that I'm your attorney of record and that you're not going to answer any questions. You know, these are human beings. They get scared. They're worried about their families. So at the time that something's happening, they may be too nervous to remember those instructions that an attorney gives them. But I think it's really, really critical to kind of emphasize you do not want to speak to a ICE agent without the presence of your attorney. It's absolutely critical, and do not sign anything because they don't know what they're signing. Some of these officers, they're good officers and bad officers. Some of these officers will not be explaining to the individual, oh, you're signing away your lawful permanent residence. Oh, you're signing your deportation. They won't explain it correctly. And so these individuals are not understanding. And in the case of my client while I was on vacation, they were trying to insist on my client, on asking my client questions relating to, his criminal background. And my client was very insistent, and despite his nerves, despite the fact that he was afraid that he would be taken into detention, he basically gave him my card and said, I have an attorney, speak to my attorney. And
okay.
What happened?
Good, thank you. I wanted to ask Susan to touch on the question of how to respond to a call-in letter. Does such a thing still exist, a call-in letter, where they tell you to voluntarily turn yourself in or bring your papers and come with your lawyer? And also, how do you postpone an ICE interview in order to be able to review a client's records to determine if there's outstanding orders and so on?
Matt, are you talking about what we used to call a bag and baggage letter, the B&B?
Yeah, or even if they're saying, come in, we want to ask you some questions. We want to look at your papers. Go ahead.
Every case is different. If I get a letter like that from ERO, from the deportation office in Chicago, on a client of mine, for a client of mine, I will pick up the phone and call the supervisor.
Mm-hmm.
Much of what we're doing right now and how local practice is implemented is sort of regional. In our call, we discovered that things in Chicago are different than things in Southern California. So in that scenario, I would pick up the phone and call the officer and then actually go over him and go to a supervisor, say, can you let me know a little bit about this? Here's my G-28. I want to know what this is, why you want to see my client. hopefully, I will already know what it's about. A good scenario would be someone has an outstanding order, and we've got an approved I-130, and they're going to go to a visa interview at Ciudad Juarez as soon as our I-601A waiver is processed. And in that in that scenario, I would forward a copy of documents to show where the client is in this process and let the supervisor know that we're willing to submit voluntarily. We'll bring a passport. We'll bring an open ticket for an itinerary with the plan and the ask that you allow us to wait until very close to our visa interview, in Salvador, let's say, and sort of negotiate back and forth an order of supervision until that individual needs to leave.
Well, it's clear that during our preparation that practices in Southern California are very different from what we're hearing about in Chicago and in, I would say, Philadelphia, where I'm located, where there's been a degree of cooperation over the years that's continued into the present time. But I think that the enhanced enforcement initiative has really taken root in Southern California. So, Patty, what can you tell me about some of the issues arising from the intersection between CIS interviews, even Customs and Border Protection at the border and the airport, and how that can lead to ICE involvement?
Well, I think it's important to understand that USCIS and CBP are all under the umbrella of the Department of Homeland Security, which ICE is one of those components of. Since the executive orders, we've seen, as Susan has mentioned, a law enforcement presence, a strong law enforcement presence. There's, in my opinion, less cooperation among the immigrant community, activists, and ICE officers and EOI officers since the executive orders. There seems to be an underlying belief that, you know, we've got the authority now on our side to basically take in people into custody without having to necessarily abide by the rules and regulations and due process that's required under the law. So there's a sense of that. There's also a sense of individuals in our community, or defense attorneys in our community, that are really, particularly NGOs, that are just taking great strides in trying to educate and be present when these immigrants are facing these kinds of difficulties. I think one of the things that we're seeing, other than the DMV issues that we're talking about and the ICE at the courthouse, is we're seeing that there is USCIS is now much more willing to refer cases to ICE for investigation than they were in the past.
Mm-hmm.
And that's actually an issue that is being addressed, like, you know, what are the factors that cause you to now refer this I-130 to ICE for investigation, or aside from, you know, possible marriage fraud, what are other factors that you're looking at that requires a case to be referred to ICE? And the other problem we have here in Southern California is, with the new executive order, every chief counsel's office, Los Angeles, San Francisco, and San Diego, are treating the executive orders differently. They're reading, or the guidelines that they've received are different. For some reason, San Diego is not agreeing to joint motions to reopen because they're of the opinion that the executive order doesn't permit them to join in motions to reopen, whereas Los Angeles is still considering some joint motions to reopen, San Francisco as well. So there is kind of like a disconnect among some of the offices and in agencies as to, okay, what do these executive orders really mean? What was handed down from headquarters, and how is OPLA, the Office of the Principal Legal Advisor, interpreting these guidelines? And because of that, you see somewhat of a disconnect between offices here in Southern California and offices in Pennsylvania and Chicago, somewhat being the enforcement issues are being treated differently, if that makes any sense.
Well, here's what I wanted to ask you about, because, Patty, you have tremendous insight and relationships with officers in Immigration and Customs Enforcement. And, Susan, you have great connections to people who were government agents over your many years as liaison committee participant. What do you hear from them? Is it a sense of confusion? Is it a sense of that they're not sure what next week's going to bring? Is there sort of, you indicate, Patty, different tactics in different offices. Do you have any insight into what the officers are dealing with?
Absolutely. In fact, I talked to one of my good friends that I'm still good friends with. Certainly the fact that I was with the agency over 17 years, and I've and the role that I had in ICE I was both the privacy officer, the training officer, and I was a part of the national security team, and I handled a lot of the federal work dealing with denaturalization. So my contact with officers was very regular, and I've, you know, kept connections, but certainly they don't do me any kind of favors at all. But in talking to one of my friends who's an ICE agent, he tells me that since the new administration, there's a sense of they don't know what they're doing. The guidelines change almost daily, and so they're not really certain how to proceed in certain cases. And that is frustrating to them because it also endangers their lives. And some of these officers really really want to do good work and do this and do good work by the book. And some of these officers are feeling pressured to
take shortcuts.
To take shortcuts. And the friends that I have don't want to do that. They want to do things by the book. They want to enforce the laws correctly and protect people's rights and protect their lives.
I think that previously there was a concern about compliance, maybe even a concern about that they might step over some sort of a legal line that would expose them to litigation. And I have a feeling that there's less of that concern today. Susan, what do you think?
You know, my experience in Chicago recently heard about more emboldened conduct from other lawyers. I've seen it a little bit. Getting back, though, to the point of sort of what to do, what we'll do with a client locally, I've been told by one of the supervisors at ERO he said to me, I would love it if you would let me know in advance when you've got somebody coming in on an I-130 interview. And let us know, so someone who has an outstanding order of removal, whose order we could enforce during an interview, but you know, and then detain and possibly remove. But let's sort of work together. So locally here in Chicago, we're able to reach out and sort of negotiate how to handle a situation where someone's could be potentially removed while appearing for an interview. Going to Patty's point, yes, we've been told they don't know what to do out of headquarters, that it changes so frequently, but at the same time, this officer said, they've let us make our own choices on a local level. So we sort of choose how to enforce the list of priorities. I think generally speaking, when you've got a client who's a mother of U.S. citizen children with no criminal history, all she has is an outstanding order of removal from years ago, that's not as likely, that's not a high a potential or a priority for ICE to arrest and then eventually remove. But it's definitely something that you need to negotiate or liaise with your local ICE offices and ERO in terms of what they're going to do.
Hearing that some of the offices who have had traditionally better connections to the immigration law community, I think that those connections and that communication can make all the difference, whereas in other districts, perhaps in the Southwest, Southern California, Texas, South Florida, perhaps, there's more of a distance, there's more of a antagonism, if you will, between the immigration enforcement and the immigration bar that can really lead to more unfettered enforcement. But I think it's important to be able to record and report officer misconduct. That's something that I have not hesitated to do in appropriate circumstances, and I always advise clients to make note of. Patty, do you have any observations about when it's appropriate to record and report officer misconduct? And then we're going to conclude in just a few minutes.
I do. I agree with you, Matt, that I think it is important to record officer misconduct. Just the other day, after the executive orders were signed, I had an individual come in to my office on a consultation basis, and he was a U.S. citizen, had been a U.S. citizen for years, unfortunately got caught with, in a criminal situation. An ICE officer showed up at the jail that he was at for the unrelated criminal matter and detained him on an ICE hold. He's a U.S. citizen. He can't be detained. So he was detained for several days before someone properly advised ICE agents that you cannot detain a U.S. citizen. So he was released. But he was released with a letter saying, show up for an interview at our offices here in San Bernardino. He comes to my office. I look at it, and I said, well, you have no reason to show up. ICE has no jurisdiction here. So why are they asking to meet with you and confer with you and interview you? So I called up and talked to the officer, and the officer was belligerent, to say the least, and basically said to me that they can conduct any interview that they want, and they can arrest a U.S. citizen if they need to. And I thought it was just because the officer was poorly trained and didn't understand the jurisdiction of ICE's jurisdiction, and I kindly told them that, well, given the fact that I did, you know, denaturalization for almost 15 years for ICE, I understand the protocol, and you need to do steps A through C, if you will, before you can even touch my client. So, and he was just belligerent towards me. So I made a note of who the officer was at the time of my call. He was unwilling to give me, you know, his first name, so I just made some calls to his supervisor, and that's not okay. You cannot abuse individuals. You cannot violate their due process rights. You cannot just play hide-and-seek with the truth. You either do your job because you have to, but you have to do it following the rules. Just like we, as defense attorneys, we have to follow rules. We have an ethical obligation to represent our clients. I'm not going to let my client be bombarded and railroaded, particularly when there's no jurisdiction that I've had in that case. So,
I think it's important to recognize that, you know, what might be okay today isn't going to be okay tomorrow, and it might take time and it might take persistence, but hopefully that the rule of law and justice will prevail. We know that in the years after the creation of the Department of Homeland Security, that it took a long time for some of these cases to get to court, but ultimately remedies were reached for many people who faced unlawful conduct by officers. But in general, I think it's a good idea to tell clients that if they are confronted by officers who are not giving their names or acting in an intimidating or abusive manner, that it's important to write down the details and to report that to supervisors, because the supervisors in most cases will not support that kind of conduct. Susan, as we wrap up, do you have any last words about how to interact with the agencies and how to interact with officers who might be pushing to the limit?
I've filed a couple different complaints over the years against officers who crossed over, and each of them was removed from the agency, I can say. So it's our job to stand up for our clients when they're abused, when you see it, and even when you see something wrong with the process, when the integrity of the process is damaged, I think that's a point to stand up and make a complaint on behalf of the client, on behalf of, you know, anybody who's having to undergo this. But that's a really good example, Patty. I commend you and congratulate you, and it must have just been felt great to do that with that officer.
It was. Thank you, Susan. Thank you. We all have those moments.
Okay,
we do.
We're going to conclude now, and my final words will simply be that we can all expect there to be a heightened enforcement environment for the time being, that people who have outstanding orders of removal need to be on their guard. Some of these people will have forms of relief available to them, and they're going to depend upon zealous advocacy to try to bring those matters in front of the courts. Thank you, ladies, for letting me participate, and thank you for all your useful insights.
Thank you, Matt. Thank you, Susan.
Thanks.